Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about the books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
You know, Sid, there's certain constants in life that you tend to depend on.
Consonants? Like in the alphabet?
Yeah, like Q and...
S, I like that one.
S is a good one. A lot of S's out there. Have you been seeing this? A lot of S's. Yeah. Like, no. Constants that you depend on. Things in the universe, you know, the sun... rises in the east and sets in the west, etc.
Like Desmond.
Like Desmond, your constant. Yes, exactly. Lost humor. Mm-hmm. Just
there's somebody out there who appreciated that. There are two people who are loving this right now.
But in medicine, which is always evolving, there's constants you rely on. And but recently, one of those has been upended, you were telling me.
Yes, that's true. You've probably seen, there's been a lot of articles in the news recently that... we have certain things that we always know to be true about the human body. There's so much we don't know, and we talk about that a lot on the show, that there's so many things that we still sort of understand, but not really. Mm-hmm. But we have relied on the fact that the inside of your mouth is a steamy 98.6 degrees. What commercial is that from?
I don't
like a
know.
Gum one?
Probably.
Anyway, we have relied on the idea that that is the human body temperature, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 degrees Celsius, in case you're a fan of Celsius.
I always remember it with the band 98 degrees and 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. So 98 degrees
you
and
can't just
6
remember.
Degrees and then 98.6. That's the mm-hmm. ones together.
Or 37.
Okay, here she goes, folks. First she wants to socialize medicine, and now she wants to bring metric into it.
I don't think I'm alone in that. But we've always relied on that being true, and from that stems a lot of like what when is your temperature too low and when is your temperature too high and what is a fever? And now here the all these articles are out there that are calling that into question. Mm. And so we've had a lot of people tweeting and posting on our Facebook page and emailing to ask, is this true? What do we do? How do we react? Everything is so frightening right now. It's
sure.
2020.
It's a trying time.
We cannot rely on anything anymore. What do we do? Even in some of the doctor groups I'm in, there's been a lot of upheaval. What do we do with this information?
Well,
how do we interpret it?
It's either that
patients?
Or talk about sports. So I'm assuming there's kind of default to the...
We usually talk about doctor stuff.
But, yeah, I assumed.
Okay. Sure. Thank you to Annie and Erica and Jordan and Lena for emailing about it. I know a lot of other people have tweeted and such, but I always check the emails. That's where I get the... In case I don't thank you for a tweet, that's why. Anyway, we have discussed...
No, by the way, that email is sawbones@maximumfun.org. We don't say it a lot.
That's true.
That's what
it
is.
We should say it more. We have talked about fevers before. We've done a whole episode on fevers and what they mean, what their use is, what their purpose could be in the human body, and then the use of a fever as medicine. But we've never really dove into where did we come up? How do we have a body? Why do we know what our body temperature should be? Where did we get that information? Who figured that out the first time and wrote that down? And why has that become such a kind of a law
mm-hmm.
that it extends beyond medicine? It's just like common knowledge.
Right.
And of course, in addition, if things are changing, what will that mean? What does that mean for us? So before we use thermometers, before there were thermometers, we measured temperature in medicine anyway, by, well, you know, the way probably your parent has checked your temperature before.
Up the butt.
What?
Putting the thermometer up the butt, right?
No, this is before thermometers.
Oh.
Justin.
Oh, hand on the head then.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. I thought you meant before like digital, because you can't put the digital ones in your butt, I don't think.
Okay. How long are we going to talk about rectal thermometers in this episode?
I don't know. You're the first one to mention them. So if there's a scoreboard, it's Sydney 1, Justin 0.
We tend to measure temperature when we don't have a thermometer or before humans had them by touching someone and seeing if they feel hot, which is still the way my mother insists on doing it because she refuses to own a thermometer.
To own a thermometer, folks. We've brought them to their house and they just disappear. It's wild.
Because she can tell if she touches you, if you have a fever.
She's a human thermometer.
On a side note, we actually, specifically in studies that have looked at maternal figures, maternal temperature measurement, we aren't terrible at this.
Okay.
Like humans aren't actually as bad as you'd think as at telling if someone has a fever just from touching them. There have been studies on this, multiple studies throughout the decades, ever since the 50s, where we have largely based on the idea of a mom feeling a child and trying to tell if they're febrile or not.
Mm-hmm.
But they did a meta-analysis of 10 of the most well-done studies in 2008. It encompassed 3,694 children. And what they found is that the sensitivity of diagnosing a fever based on touch, based on, and again, a lot of these studies were a mom feeling their child to see if they thought they had a fever, range from 70% to 97%. That's different, by the way, from the specificity, which was a lot wider, 19% to 90%. And let me break that down. What that means is that we are pretty good at ruling out a fever. I'll include myself as a maternal unit myself. We are pretty good, about 89% good at touching a kid and saying, no, there's not a fever here. But when it comes to ruling in a fever, does this kid have a fever? We're about 50-50.
Okay.
So I thought that was very interesting.
Probably because of the range, right, between like febrile and normal, right?
Yes.
You tell if it's above normal, but not necessarily febrile or not.
Mm-hmm. And also we are pretty good at feeling a kid and going, nah, this kid does not have a fever. So I thought that was pretty interesting that actually maternal touch is not completely, and I think you could extrapolate that to paternal touch or parental touch or guardian touch.
Yeah.
Well, I these studies they date back to the 50s, and so I think a lot of them just
makes sense.
Yeah, focused on that relationship, but certainly I think you could extrapolate that to,
it was illegal for dads to check their kids' temperatures.
You could probably extrapolate that not just to children, but to people touching, you know, to adults touching each other to see if they have fevers. But anyway, a thermometer is preferable, especially if you're trying to make like a big major, do I go to the ER or not kind of decision. Yeah, I'd say a thermometer is a better way to do that than touching someone's forehead, which if you're going to do it, use the back of your hand, please. That's the, you get a better, more accurate feel.
Okay.
But get a thermometer.
Just buy a thermometer, yeah.
So the idea that we should use a device to measure temperature is obviously a very old one because its uses expand far beyond medicine, right? Like that's not the only time we need to measure the temperature of something is when it's a human body. There are lots of situations in which knowing the temperature of anything.
I mean, candy making right there.
There you go. Cooking meat.
Good. Yes, important.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather have well-cooked meat than underdone candy, I guess.
I'm certain there are many industrial examples that we would nod approvingly.
Imagine in this case we're noting some of those that we're aware of.
And the idea that you could maybe use the expansion and contraction of a substance as that relates to temperature in order to like define an amount of heat, right? Like something expanding and contracting when it's heated and cooled to tell you how hot or cold it is. That idea dates back to ancient Greece. And you see throughout history all these attempts by different scientists to try to construct something that would accurately do this every time and would give you precise results so that you could repeat it over and over. And this water is always this temperature, no matter how many times I dip this thermometer in it. Mm-hmm. A lot of these were made using water and air, and you can find all different. I mean, like Galileo had a version of a thermometer of sort, thermoscope, really. Santorio, Ferdinando de Medici. There are all these different scientists who created these devices, but they weren't standardized. There was no scale yet. Like, what did that amount of heat mean? There was no Fahrenheit yet to name it. So
it was like very hot, too hot, not hot enough.
Yeah. So there was no scale. It wasn't standardized. And they mixed because they were using like air and water in a lot of these devices. They actually pressure would also influence the movement inside the devices. So it was both a barometer and what we would call probably a thermoscope. So these were not really great at measuring just temperature yet. Mm-hmm. There was one that was made with brandy that solved for this a little bit, but we still don't see a more reliable thermometer until 1714 when Daniel Fahrenheit makes one using mercury. And that's when we start to see it's a device that can be used, you know, more precisely.
What are the odds, by the way, that a guy named Daniel Fahrenheit would make a thermometer? That is wild. That goes to show you, folks, you never know.
Well,
fate,
I mean,
mystery, it's all out there.
Well, I mean,
weird.
In the years that followed, we're just going to let that go. In the years that followed, physicians started using these devices in clinical practice, started to get the idea that we know that we already had the concept of a fever, right? Mm-hmm. And we talk about in the fever episode, it took us a long time to figure out that fever is a symptom and not a disease in and of itself. But we understood that it was associated with a disease state.
Sure, right.
And so we saw some utility in trying to accurately tell if someone's temperature was elevated or not. And so thermometers entered medical practice. Boerhaave was the first one to use it regularly in clinical practice. You may remember him.
Might I?
Of ruptured esophagus fame.
Oh, my.
Boerhaave syndrome.
That Boerhaave? Mm-hmm.
When your esophagus ruptures, that's what we call it. For that Boerhaave. There are a handful of medical professionals who email me after things like this on our episodes that really appreciate it. You know who you are. These jokes are for you.
Yes. I hope those emails come with free coupons to the asthma store.
Anyway, they're the same ones that were very excited when I talked about Ringer and the lactated Ringers. Anyway, it is important to note that these thermometers were not easy to use when we're talking about patients. It's one thing if you're dipping it into a vat of like candy that you're making, mm-hmm. right? Like the candy, you don't have to ask it to hold still or anything. It's just there. You can kind of probably attach it to something. You don't even have to hold it. But these instruments could be up to a foot long. They were anywhere from like 9 to 12 inches long. Mm-hmm. And they took about 20 minutes to register a temperature.
Dang. That's a long time to hold your butt still.
And we were usually putting it under the arm, an axillary temperature.
Okay. Less accurate, right?
Yes. Tends to measure lower. And you had to hold it, like I said, you had to hold it there for about 20 minutes and you had to read it in its position. Like you had to keep it. It wasn't like something where you could like take it out and look at it. As soon as you took it out, it would start to change. So you had to read it wherever.
Right in the armpit. Get right in there.
No, it was just, I mean, it was a cumbersome device to use.
I feel like mercury thermometers, by the way, are the thing, one of the things that like separate us from the current generation of young people. Like, I feel like if you had to, I have such unpleasant memories of having to hold this gross glass tube underneath my tongue for extended periods of time. Do they still sell them? Could I buy them on Amazon right now?
Oh, I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can.
They haven't just completely done away with them?
No.
I guess you can. I guess you can still get
one. You can still get them. We don't, I have never used one, like in an office or hospital setting. because now we just all use the various digital varieties. But so
looks like mercury is not as popular anymore. Even the liquid and glass ones are. It looks like there's less mercury out there.
Well, although most people aren't going to accidentally break them, you can.
Sure. That was always my fear, that I'd bite it in half and drink a bunch of mercury.
I do not think you are the only child that had that fear.
Okay, good. Good to know.
So these devices that I'm describing are the ones that Carl Reinhold August Wunderlich, I want to say. Probably the, I listened to it. I think I'm saying it right.
Okay.
Would use.
It doesn't sound like you want to say. It sounds like you don't want to say. It sounds like you want to call him Carl.
I'll call him Dr. Carl. No, Wunderlich is what I would, in my American English, say. Would use to conduct his landmark study on what is the temperature of a human?
What temperature are we?
And Dr. Wunderlich was a German physician from the mid 1800s. And like I said, he wasn't the first one to use a thermometer in clinical practice, but he was one of the first ones to say, well, I mean, this is cool. We can do this, but what do these numbers mean? We don't have any kind of standard. Like, what's the reference?
Mm-hmm.
Your temperature's 99. Okay. Next. What? You know, right. what do we do with that information? So he was the first one to put all that together. So some things about this physician, so that we kind of know what kind of fella he was. He practiced internal medicine and psychiatry, and he wrote in defense, even before his kind of landmark work, the thing he is most well known for, I would say, is this temperature stuff we're going to talk about. Even before then, he wrote in defense of the scientific method a lot, which, I mean, I like.
Yeah, it's weird that he has to do that, but I guess those are the 1800s for you.
At this point in medicine, it's really interesting. It was kind of a crossroads for the practice of medicine in terms of, should we be more philosophical in our approach to medicine, which is how doctors had practiced since the beginning of history, and kind of like diseases and diagnoses and treatments should fit into these like high-minded kind of theoretical views about the human body and the human psyche and like our place on earth and all these things.
More art versus science.
Right. Or should we just like study things, figure out what works and do that?
Mm-hmm.
And he was a strong believer in introducing the scientific method to medical practice, which does not sound like it should be
revolutionary. Yeah, right.
But was.
Yeah.
And he, like I said, wrote articles begging other doctors, like, could we do this science-like? Could we be scientists, please? Thank you. And one of the ways in which he sought to improve medicine as a science was by using, you know, standardized devices to measure and record things, to observe and record. That's part of scientific method, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he used the thermometer to standardize what our understanding of a normal human body temperature is in order for us to further define what an abnormal human body temperature is.
Mm-hmm.
And he did this by measuring lots and lots and lots of temperatures.
Everybody's got a temperature. Everybody's got.
That's true.
5 minutes.
20 minutes. That's the thing you have to remember. So when he collected all this data that he would eventually publish, he was using one of these. There's one in the Mutter Museum you can look at now if you are interested in Philadelphia. They have one of his actual thermometers that he used. Obviously, there was more than one. This
gross.
The one they have on display, I think, is like 9 inches long. But the instruments could be anywhere from 9 to 12 inches. They would try to measure every patient twice a day. Like I said, these were axillary, so under the armpit temperatures, and about 20 minutes a pop for these measurements taken while they were in position. So a cumbersome process to collect all this data, because he did this for about 25,000 patients.
Wow.
So a lot of data. I mean, really, if you start thinking about, for anyone out there who does like data analysis, statistical analysis, how many numbers he was compiling with paper and pen. I mean, that's
wild.
That's how he was doing this. He was just writing all this down. And so he collected all this data. And in 1868, he published his work on the subject that literally translated from the German was The Behavior of Self-Heat in Disease, or when it was published in English, On the Temperature in Diseases, A Manual of Medical Thermometry. And in this landmark work published in 1868, he defined a normal human body temperature as 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 37 degrees Celsius. And in addition, he made some other, you know, there were a lot of observations about human temperature. This is the most well known, but he also noted that our temperatures tend to be lower in the morning. So like your body will hit its low between 2 and 8 a.m. and it will be higher in the evening. So sometime between 4 and 9 p.m., your body temperature is the highest. Generally speaking, he found that women had higher body temperatures than men. He also thought that women's temperatures could fluctuate more readily. And old people tend to have lower temperatures than younger people. He also, within this work, defined a fever as a temperature of 100.4 Fahrenheit or 38 degrees Celsius. I wonder how old that definition is.
I wonder how he did the second one. The first one makes sense. It's just averages. But the second one seems like you're kind of making a little bit more of a, I mean, your own sort of distinction there.
It's a centigrade higher than normal.
It makes more sense. It's all so much easier to keep track of.
If you go with Celsius. Yeah. So
Celsius is metric, right? I don't have that wrong, do I?
No, that's metric.
It's metric. Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Yeah, it's so 37 is normal, 38 is a fever. That's according to Wunderlich and this study from 1868 that, and this definition, as I said in the fever episode, exists today. This is still what we are teaching at maybe at this very moment in medical schools across the country. Across the world, 100.4 or 38, depending on where you are.
So how did it all get messed up?
Well, I wanna dig into all this data to help us understand why this is in question. But before we do that, let's go to the billing department.
Let's go. The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth. You got so much to take care of. Spring's right around the corner. You're busy. You're cleaning up, you're getting your life back in order, you're getting ready to emerge like from your chrysalis, like a beautiful butterfly. You don't have time to slave away in the kitchen. You don't have time to waste a bunch of time cooking dinner that you don't have time to do. You got to get out there, but you still got to feel your body, give it the delicious, fresh stuff that it craves, right? Well, good news, because there's Factor. These meals are always fresh, never frozen, and they're ready to eat in about 2 minutes. You don't have to prep them. No prep, no stress. Slap them in the microwave, heat them up, and they're going to be delicious. Not like the microwave meals you remember from when you were a kid, kind of grody. These are nice. These are designed by dietitians. They're crafted by chefs. So you're going to eat well. You're going to eat in a way that sustains you and makes you happy. And it's not going to take a lot of your time. Head to factormeals.com/sawbones50off and use code sawbones50off to get 50% off and free breakfast for a year. Eat like a pro this month with Factor. New subscribers only, varies by plan. One free breakfast item per box, one for 1 year while subscription is active. You know, sometimes I waste too much time thinking. Thought is the root of all suffering. You know, that's something that I've heard that I think there's a lot of truth in. So why don't we try let go of thought and get into action, right? Get your project in front of you and start building a website for it with Squarespace. Squarespace is a fantastic tool for creating your website because, first of all, you can start building out these ideas in a way that lets you visualize them, right? I'm not a thinker that thinks in words. I have to think in images. So with a Squarespace website, you're able to start taking that idea out of your brain and putting it in front of you. And it's going to look great because the templates you're going to be using are made by world-class designers, some of the best in the biz. And if you're having trouble with any of the stuff that you're doing with your Squarespace website, they have incredible support that's there to have your back every step of the way. And with a Squarespace website, you can't just like share information. You can really kind of do anything with these websites. You can sell products, calendars, just keeping in touch, whatever. The Squarespace tools are incredibly powerful and flexible and well worth checking out. Head to squarespace.com/sawbones for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code sawbones to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. All right, so how did we continue to look at this data that is way older than I thought it would be?
Yes. So there are obviously some issues that I've already kind of alluded to that you may, if you are someone like me who every time I read a study, I start trying to look for holes in it. Not because I'm a skeptic, but because I want to make sure that I can believe all the data that's being presented and the conclusions that are being presented. And the stuff that is in there actually leads to the conclusions at the end of the paper.
Right.
That's important to know. And there are some issues. First of all, of course, axillary temps are not... axilla, taking a temperature under the armpit,
okay,
is not the preferred method. So already my doctor mind was going, well, that's not the best way to take a temperature. But if I'm doing this episode because there's data that shows perhaps the human body temperature is actually lower than we suspected, then the axillary temperature should have been lower, not higher.
Right.
So already this is thrown off a little bit. Reading the device twice a day, 20 minutes in place. It was all very cumbersome to collect that data.
But you would assume that 25,000 people, that would equalize with that many different.
You would assume. Now, he did have a fairly large margin of error. He felt that half a degree centigrade or 0.9 Fahrenheit wiggle room.
Considerable.
Was allowed. Yes, that is a considerable amount of wiggle room when we start talking about what we think that the human body temperature actually is. I mean, we're not talking about giant fluctuations necessarily in terms of like sheer numbers. It's what does it mean that's more compelling. But there's also, as I said, a statistical point to be made. How do you analyze 25,000 patients worth of data without a computer?
Hmm. Just hard to do the actual math.
I mean, I'm not saying you can't. Of course, people did. Of course, people functioned before computers.
Sure.
But it's a lot harder to decide, do I have a representative sample? Am I making sure? I mean, he was checking both sick and healthy people randomly. How can he make sure that he got an even split of genders, that he got an even split of ages, that he got right. an even split of healthy and sick people, of different times of day, of different, you know, things like throughout a menstrual cycle that can influence temperature,
sure,
or pregnant or not pregnant, or all these different things that can influence a body temperature. How do we know that he got an even split in a representative sample? Those are hard. That's hard analysis to do mm-hmm. with pencil and paper, and especially at this point in history. So all the ways that we analyze data, when we collect a ton of numbers and then try to make conclusions from them, a lot of those statistical methods of analysis had really become set in place in the 1830s. We're not that far out from then at this point. And so the idea that they would be in widespread, easy use by, you know, Wunderlich and all of his researchers that he must have had working with him. I mean, he couldn't have done all this alone.
It's a lot of armpits, for one.
This would be very difficult to do. And again, that's not me saying it's impossible. Clearly, people collected and analyzed data before they had a computer to do it. But it would have been quite a challenge. Mm-hmm. And the idea that there is error in those numbers is not wild to think.
Sure.
You know, it's not a stretch to say, well, maybe the results aren't quite as reliable as we thought. Which is why by the 1980s, people were starting to ask, did we get this right?
Mm-hmm.
Is 98.6 really the average body temperature? Is 100.4 really a fever? Should we really trust this data? Or maybe, since it's been a while, should we
check again?
Check again.
Let's just check again.
And I think it's interesting because he was so committed to the scientific method, and because he really did try to do the best he could with the tools and the instruments he had of the day, a lot of researchers were kind of daunted by the number of participants they'd have in a study to confirm or deny the results.
Right.
I mean, he did 25,000 patients.
It's a lot.
That's a lot. That's a lot of people. And so a lot of researchers were kind of reluctant to tackle this.
Mm-hmm.
So we start to see smaller studies to try to reproduce these results. Back in the 90s is when you first start to see people saying, like, well, what's an easy place to start? I mean, like, let's take some temperatures and average them out and see where we're getting. And smaller groups of studies seem to indicate that maybe 98.6 isn't completely accurate. And so the first thought was, well, maybe it was the instrument. Maybe thermometers are different. maybe they're better now. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm certainly they're better now. So why don't we get that thermometer from the Motor Museum and check it out?
How?
Well, we just get it and we measure some stuff with it. And we use a modern thermometer next to it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, right? And see how accurate it is.
Yeah. I guess, though, I would worry that, like, something has changed. I mean, it's very old at this point, right? It's a very old thermometer. I would worry that, like, something could have changed about the thermometer itself.
What could have changed, Dustin? What would it have been made of, these old thermometers?
Glass.
Yeah.
The mercury got old in it.
Well, yes, but the glass, I mean, the glass is the thing here.
What? I don't know. It's
glass can change over time.
That's true, because it's all sand. Could expand and contract. It's all hard sand moving around. It's little good. Grains of sand moving around.
You're thinking more critically.
This is a first. This is as close to a compliment as you get. I'm going to savor the moment. Please continue.
I appreciate that you're thinking that way, because that is exactly one of the thoughts. So they did this. Let me start with, they did this study. They took the thermometer that they have at the Motor Museum, and they in the 90s, and some researchers used some like standardized temperature water baths. You know, we know exactly what temperature this water bath is. Mm-hmm. And let's measure it with this thermometer, and we can compare to a modern thermometer and see how close we can get. And the old thermometer that Wunderlich would have used did measure higher consistently. They okay. found higher than the temperature.
Okay.
So that was very interesting data. And so then some people said, well, I was just, that's the problem then. That's why we've had it wrong all these years.
Because the thermometers were wrong.
The thermometers were wrong. And that seems to be an easy solution to this question. Now, what you said though is true. A lot of researchers noted glass does change over time, and the smallest change in the size of the bulb could change what the eventual result on the thermometer, what the reading would be. So this is a really old thermometer. Are we sure it wasn't more accurate, you know, 100 yeah. years ago yeah. than it is now? But it did call some things into question. So they continued to repeat studies throughout the later 90s and into the early 2000s on smaller groups of participants at first. Mm-hmm. And they consistently showed lower average temperatures than the 98.6. They consistently got, the first one was like 98.2, which is 36.8 was the average. And there was a more recent one that was 97.7. Mm. And the most recent in 2017 analyzed over 35,000 patients. It's a lot of temperature readings.
Yeah.
It's like 250,000 temperature readings, I think. And they came out at 97.9.
Wow, so pretty low.
Yes.
But considerably less.
So we're beginning to think like maybe it wasn't just thermometer difference. Maybe I don't know. Are humans getting colder? So that's one of the two questions.
That's not where I would jump to, I wouldn't think.
That is that, I mean, if you have to keep an open mind, remember you have to ask the question. And the two questions that arose from this, all this data, and I think one is the one that I am hearing asked most frequently right now of me because of these news stories. The number one question is, what is a fever? Mm-hmm. Because I think that there are a lot of proponents of the so-called low-grade fever mm-hmm. who are now rejoicing in triumph.
You just raised your eyebrows at me in a very challenging way. All I'm saying is that if it's over 100, you're sick. That's all I'm saying.
There are a lot of people who have for a long time contested that a 99 anything, 99 point literally anything degree temperature is a quote unquote low grade fever. And we are taught in medicine that there is no such thing really as a low grade fever, unless what you mean is 100.4 is the lowest possible fever. So I guess that is a low grade fever as a compared to 101, 102, 103,
right,
which would be a higher grade fever. These really aren't distinctions, though, that have a clinical significance to mm-hmm. us. So like it's not necessarily something that I'm going to base any decision making off of.
Right.
And we have always dismissed that like, well, 99 isn't a fever. So it's a low grade nothing. It's just not a fever. Mm-hmm. However, based on these new numbers, in theory, a fever would start around 99.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And so then the question
if the difference is the same.
Yes.
Consistent. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, have we been wrong to use this cutoff for a fever? That's one big question that arises from this this kind of shift. I would say that before everybody freaks out and starts checking their temperature and thinking about all the times that maybe they were sick and they didn't know it. I would clarify, and this is an important point. The people who did this study, the researchers, the doctors who actually did this study, are not proposing that we change any standard temperatures, guidelines, definitions, any normal ranges based on this study. They say that. They're not proposing that we change this. They're just saying this is interesting. We need to think about it. But
you got to give it to these guys that measured, 35,000 different people. And at the end, they were like, hey, listen, this was a big waste of time. don't do anything different. Just throw us in the trash. We're sorry. No. This is a big waste of time.
They're good scientists.
Keep with your old thing.
They're good scientists because they're saying this is compelling to know, but we don't necessarily know that it changes what we do as doctors. Like, it changes maybe some things we knew about the human body, but should that change our medical practice? Well, we've used 100.4 as the cutoff for a clinically significant infection for a really long time now.
And we've made it this far. Is that the argument? Like, we've made it this far.
We've based our management strategies on this, right?
Sure, right.
And we don't really have any compelling data to suggest that if we had been calling 99.5 a fever all these years, that we would have done anything different or treated people differently or saved a life or prolonged a life or started in medicine sooner. I think it's hard to make that kind of case because we've used that standard for so long. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's impossible. I just think it's to draw that conclusion from this study would be, completely out of that. That would be out of bounds. Okay. That would be a complete over-exaggeration of what the data really says. A fever is a symptom. It is not dangerous. We know that the top ends, we still know like the temperatures that we need to worry about, right?
Right.
Like if you have a fever of 101, of course you're sick, but that 101 degree temperature is not going to harm your body. If you have a fever of 106, please get to the hospital immediately.
Right.
Yes, that is concerning. Those numbers haven't changed. And we still over-treat fevers, as we talked about in our fever episode. There's just because you have a fever doesn't necessarily mean we have to do anything about it.
Sure.
About the fever itself.
Right. Because it's a symptom.
Yes. Yes. So I would say that does this change our understanding of a fever? Not in a huge clinically significant way. It's interesting. And certainly if you're feeling sick and your temperature is 99.5, maybe you're a little more inclined to take the day off, stay home and recuperate.
Yeah.
And you don't have to feel like you got to justify it with a temperature of 100.4
right.
to you or your boss or anybody else. But I would say that it doesn't really change a lot about what we understand about a fever. But the second question is really the more interesting one, because what if it is that we're getting colder? What if it isn't that the thermometers were wrong?
Mm-hmm.
What if the human body has actually gotten colder? And the most recent study, the reason this is in the news is because of a study that was just published that looked at all this data from all these different studies and said, can we figure out if humans are actually getting colder? And it wasn't the thermometers. And so researchers took data from like human temperature data that was collected between 1862 and 1930, okay. another chunk that was collected from 1971 and 1975, and a third chunk that was collected from 2007 to 2017, and compared these three different data sets over time,
mm-hmm.
and found that we are indeed trending downward in body temperature.
That's wild. Why would that be?
A steady downward trend in body temperature.
Why?
This was led by Dr. Julie Parsonet. And it was, I believe it was like every decade we go down like 0.05. degrees.
Weird.
Yeah. And it was really interesting. And they found a way to control because they had like the data set, the earliest one that was from 1862 to 1930, that's a pretty wide range. They could control from decade to decade, which removes a lot of the thermometer variability.
Mm-hmm.
And they still found the downward trend.
That's so weird.
So they really don't think it's a thermometer tech issue.
Mm-hmm.
It really appears to be based on this study. It really appears to be that we are getting colder. And again, they say the same thing. We're not proposing that you change any guidelines. Please just continue, doctors, with your current standard of medical care.
It's just the thing is we're all getting colder, but everybody just be, if you'll pardon the pun, chill about it.
If everybody could just calm down, we got bigger problems right now. You just happen to also be getting colder. So why? Why are we getting colder?
Earth's getting hotter. We're balancing it out.
Okay, both of these things are true, that we are getting colder and Earth, well, we think the Earth, we know that Earth is getting hotter. We think that we are getting colder. However, that is not
mine's
a
not
causal
that.
Relationship.
You do have to,
that is not
you
causal.
Have to ask the question. A wise woman once told me, you have to ask the question, Sydney.
Yes, and I am telling you, no, it is not. While the Earth is indeed getting warmer, it is not because the Earth is getting warmer that humans may well be getting colder.
Got it. Earth's getting warmer, humans getting colder. We are
no relation.
We're in agreement. We're in agreement about this. This fact.
Well, so the theory that Dr. Parsonet puts forth in the study, and then the other researchers, because we're not sure, but the theory is that back before we lived, most of us in homes with temperature control and like regular hygiene and the ability to change our clothes mm-hmm. and wash ourselves and eat food that isn't contaminated and get vaccines and all these different things. Mm-hmm. Back before all of that, humans were exposed to a lot more microbes on a regular basis. We were constantly being invaded by bacteria and viruses and fungi and parasites and all this. Mm-hmm. And so we always had this sort of baseline, maybe inflammatory cytokine release in our bodies. So if you took our temperatures, you were much more likely to find these elevated temperatures because we were always kind of hot because our bodies were always in the midst of reacting to something.
We had like a low level body was working overtime with all these different bad invaders.
Yes.
And now the environment is doing a bit more of that for us.
Yes. I think it's a combination of less inflammation because of our environment and temperature control because most of us tend to live indoors now. Mm-hmm. And that the combination of those things has just led us to be colder now.
Weird.
We're just colder. Our temperature tends to be 97.9 around okay. that. It
Weird.
Seems to be, but something lower. What does that mean for the future of humans? I don't think anybody really knows. I don't think it's necessarily, no one is suggesting that it's detrimental or
nope.
bad.
No one's saying anything about it. It sounds like they're just saying we're getting colder and everybody just go about your day.
And it won't continue forever. I mean, certainly everybody would assume it would level off at some point.
You would hope.
But it seems like, and again, this is one study that indicates this, and it is always important. The reason I talk a lot about like the way that I approach a study, you can't, every time you read a scientific study, even a really well done one, mm-hmm. even one that I can't, with my little skeptic scope poke holes in.
This is available at McElroyMerch.com, Sydney McElroy skeptic scope.
Even if it's a really well done study and the evidence is really compelling that they have arrived at, the conclusions are really compelling and the data supports them, one study cannot change a complete scientific paradigm. We cannot shift our entire understanding of a scientific principle, of a medical principle, of the human body, of the world, of the earth, based on one study. Mm-hmm. It's got to be reproducible. We have to continue to be able to see those same results when we check it again and again and again. Otherwise, you could miss something. Otherwise, there could have been a variable you didn't know about, something that confounded it. And so it's always important when you hear these things in the news. It's really interesting. Of course, everybody wants to hear about it and read about it. Fascinating.
Right.
What does it mean? We're getting colder. Why?
Who knows? Nobody knows.
But I would not approach it with fear or trepidation. It's interesting. Perhaps we've expanded our knowledge of the way the human body works, the way we're constantly changing and evolving and adapting to our environment. It's fascinating. It's interesting. We can incorporate it into our vast body of medical knowledge. But it is nothing to fear. It is nothing to like change your entire perception of what your body temperature and what your body's doing and what a fever is. And
all right.
And of course, any good scientist would tell you, we gotta try it a few more times before we're sure about the results.
Folks, thank you so much for listening to our podcast, Sawbones. Hey, if you want to come see us live, you can do that. If you go to bit.ly/20funny, you can get tickets to see us in Cincinnati on February 19th, opening for My Brother and Me. There's a link to get tickets there. Act fast, though. Those are running low. We have a book called The Sawbones Book, and you can pick it up at Amazon or wherever fine books are sold. Thanks to the Max Fun Network for letting us be a part of their extended podcasting family. And thank you to the taxpayers for the use of their song Medicines as the intro and outro of our program. That is going to do it for us, though, for this week. So until next time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.